Welcome to another episode of Oral Fixation. You're here, we're queer, get used to it. If you're new, my bestie Drew and I cover a different album each episode, either loved by queer people or made by a queer artist. This episode, we're joined by DJ, photographer, all-round arty queer in the know, and my old mate from uni, Matthew Arthur Williams, to explore the legendary Joni Mitchell and her 1975 album, The Hissing of Summer Lawns, released by Asylum Records. If you haven't heard it, now's a great time to pause this ep, give it a listen, and come back. Each and every audio sample you hear in this episode has been used specifically for the purposes of review and critique, and we really hope you enjoy listening. Well then, welcome to another episode of Oral Fixation, Drew.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure this fortnight to introduce one of my blasts from the past to you. You love it when I introduce you to a blast from my past.
Bring it on. There's so many different nooks and unexplored crannies of Andy's past lives. And I'm always so interested to meet the people that you've brushed up against before me. So
it's very that. Brushing is a key verb here. And this person, I know him as Matthew Arthur Williams. But you may know him, and this isn't to you, Drew, this is just to our listening audience, may know him as Jungle Hussy. he's just motioning to cut that. We'll cut that. That'll be edited out. welcome to the pod, Matthew. It's great to have you here.
It's nice to be invited. So funny, that introduction was cute. Thanks.
And we've got that lovely London accent coming through, but you are in Glasgow, are you not?
That's right, I am, yeah. I can't even put on a Glaswegian accent for you if I tried.
Well, we're not going to ask you to try, but we are going to ask you what the weather's like.
Oh, you know what? It's quite mild. It's grey, but it is mild for... September's usually good in Glasgow. Like, you always get a little bit of that September heat still. When I say heat, I mean like 12 degrees.
But you do get, I tell you what you do get, which I miss so much is, and I'm guessing it's probably coming to a bit more of a close now, but those long summer nights that just last until, like it's light until like 9:30. Yeah. Honestly, what I wouldn't give to be sat in a patio in Glasgow or wherever with a glass of rosé at 9:30 at night.
It lasts till midnight. It lasts at least like 11, like in 20th to the 2nd of July, 20th of June to at least 2nd of July, you would just get the longest like evenings. And then, yeah, I was just on the Hebrides and I saw the Northern Lights for the first time ever. And I was just like, what the fuck? Madness. But wow. Yeah.
As soon as I can get my ass back to the UK, it's up to the Hebrides with me. Boys, how do you know each other? How did you brush up against one another? I'm dying to know.
I lived on Mordeth Road I lived on, I can't remember the street, but it was off Mordeth Road in Fallowfield, Manchester in 2010. And Andrew lived on a street off Mordeth Road in 2010. No, what street were you on? You were literally about
Derby
two streets
Road.
Away.
Well, so in Fallowfield in Manchester, I lived on Platt Lane in my second year, and I lived on Derby Road in my third year.
You guys are giving me geography.
We're giving you geography. And actually, before we get into Manchester, I did wonder, Matthew, with you just briefly talking about Glasgow, also shout out to rosé being Drew's drink of choice in Glasgow. Is rosé Glaswegian? Do we get that vibe? Or is it sort of a murky, sort of peaty whiskey? Anyway, I digress. Matthew, Manchester is known as being this kind of creative hotbed because mainly because the weather is so shite. So it's known for incredible music, you know, art, nightlife, and typically people always talk about how, because the weather is so oppressive, it just makes creative people just kind of be their best and create the art and the sunshine for themselves. Do you think there's something in that with also your move to Glasgow, or is my theory nonsense.
No, but maybe there is a bit of a theory then that Glasgow also has that. But then there's the other factors that makes Glasgow incredible. Like also being a deprived and quite, well, it's not always deprived. It's very poor, but there's actually really affluent areas to Glasgow. But because the weather is so oppressive, people do band together and become quite creative in other ways. But maybe, I don't know, I moved to Glasgow because I got sick of London. And my boyfriend lived in Glasgow. So it made a lot of sense to not do a big commute, to do a long distance thing that was 400 miles.
That's interesting because I moved to Australia because I got sick of London, but my boyfriend lived in London.
Wow.
So as far as possible as I could make the commute, the better. But anyway, so sorry, you guys lived on adjacent streets. And
yeah, given the boring version there. Look, now, I remember seeing you strolling through Sainsbury's Fallowfield and thinking, I know him from somewhere. That is queer. And it turned out, I think I was already following you on Twitter, which is also queer. Maybe that's wrong, but I just remember somehow, some way, as coming into each other's orbit and deciding to hang out, and you were focusing a lot on your photography then. And I know that somewhere in the annals of the internet is some highly embarrassing photos of me taken in my third year bedroom by you, which will not be sharing on the Instagram account.
They will be in the show notes, listeners. I will dig them out.
I don't know why you think they're embarrassing. They're great.
Oh, but mainly my most amazing memories of you are just the dance floor and Bollocks and Homo Electric and all of those incredible nights in Manchester, many of which are still going, but I just have this very special place in my heart and my mind, and one day we will live those memories again. But one of the things I love about you, Matthew, is you have actually introduced me to different pieces of art, which I think I've probably told you drunkenly how much it means to me, and you just roll your eyes and move on, and that's fine, I get it. But I'm going to tell you again, because, Matthew, you really got me into Kate Bush. You didn't introduce me to Kate Bush, but you really, like, umphed up my adoration, and she remains top three for me to this day.
Deep friend of the
remember in our early days, we would also talk a lot about Bjork. We'd also talk a lot about Prince. I vividly remember, and I've talked about in previous episodes when we touched on these artists, like how those different artists came to me in a very formative time when I was trying to build out kind of my musical knowledge and exploring these different kind of icons and legends. And I also remember sitting with you very vividly in a park and you telling me about this book that you were going to give to me called Tales of the City.
Oh, yeah.
And you said that you had been given it to you by someone else. Mm-hmm. And when I have given that book to so many people in the last 10 years, I always tell them the story about how someone gave it to me and someone gave it to them. And that book is just, I mean, that's a whole nother episode. But you, like, have gifted these different parts of, like, queer culture to me.
And Andy, who did you give that book to?
I've given it to your sister. I've given it to you.
Yes, thank you.
I've given it to various friends. I gave it to my mother. So many people in my life have read that book.
There you go. Exactly. Mm. I need to pass it on, actually. I need to pass it on.
Yeah, that's its legacy. And like, it's a part of it. Like that, there's been so many people where that book has traveled, and it's how it's supposed to go. You're supposed to pass it on. It's supposed to be like, here. Here's this gift, and like it just enters you in this way that is, yeah, it's beyond. I forgot about Tales of the City. In fact, yeah, Armistead Moblin's now in London, and I think somebody bumped into him randomly on the street. Oh yeah, I used to work in a gallery, and I connected with one of my gallery directors, and we used to talk about Tales of the City and how much it had changed our lives, and she bumped into Armistead Moblin, I think like a month ago, on the street in London, because that's where he lives now. And just like it shook her core to just like somebody who had influenced her life so much, and like just to bump into them. It's like incredible.
But speaking about queer influences and gifting culture, I guess that brings us to the topic of this episode, because out of all of those people I just listed, Prince, Kate Bush, Bjork, the list goes on, Janet, the artist in the years following who I got the impression that, like, became really important to you is Joni Mitchell. And I vividly remember you giving me specific songs. This was back in the iTunes days. You gave me certain songs from some of her 90s albums, and I was like, I really just don't know anything about this person apart from, like, the very, very obvious main ones. Yeah. And you gave me some obscure stuff from the 90s, and I loved it. But in the years since, I've then been on my own Joni mission and know the big albums really well, I feel like, and I've got a lot more respect for her now. But you asked Drew and I to explore an album for this episode, which I wouldn't say is one of her most well-known ones, or am I wrong there?
No, it's well-known. It's probably not even my favourite album. When I said I was going to select it, I was like, why have I selected Hissing Over the Summer Lawns? But I don't have a favourite album. It's like Prince. And it's funny that you mentioned these other artists because they all have such admiration for Joni, and Joni has admiration for them. And it's a way in which we change how we think about the music. And especially this album, which came out in 1975, the whole 70s was all about the LP, not the single. You've gone from 60s pop records, which were just like, you know, you'd have a single here and there. But it was all about like an 8-track or a 10-track album. And you have to consume it from start to finish. Usually they're between 38 minutes and maybe 46 minutes. So you already have a time frame of how you're going to like take this in. I think the reason why I sent you all that 90s stuff is because I also find it really valuable. I find her whole like career and the way in which she's made music and her artistry something that you just need to... you need to explore everything. So you could talk about one album, but you're talking about them all, because without one album that came maybe 5 years before, you wouldn't get the one that came 10 years later. You wouldn't get what she was up to in the 90s if you didn't have this whole experimental field in the 70s, post-sexual liberation and hippie Woodstock 60s stuff. You wouldn't get all that stuff. So I think it's important to talk about these little moments where all that like fun experimentation, jazz fusion, rock mixing with folk music is quite interesting to then explore, discover, and then figure out how do you get to like the next two albums that are really more like substantial, even further than Blue. Like Blue's the big album, everyone talks about Blue because that's just like personal grieving, but also like resolving something that is like, I don't know, yeah, you lose your child or you give your child away and you lose the partner that you had that child with, and you're also trying to just create your own successes in, I guess, your career. And, you know, you pour that into an album and then it's received so well that you don't really know how to do. What can you do with that when you're so open about who you are, what you've done, and then everyone's like, that was amazing, and then you think, okay, what do I do next? I don't know. I just really appreciate that kind of artistry. And I think she is an artist. And then when you want to talk about Prince and Kate Bush, they are also of that, you know, that level of just like they're living in their own artistry, regardless of reviews, critics, and all the other stuff. They're just moving through the planet as a human being.
Exactly that. Drew, what's your knowledge of Joni Mitchell up until this point? Like, where have you crossed paths?
So I think that, like most people, as you just referenced, Matthew, my main touchstone with Joni was Blue up until about 3 years ago. I guess a little bit of Both Sides Now, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the newer Both Sides Now I knew, because she do like two, right? And then... yeah, the more recent one I knew probably because of the Love Actually connection. But then before I came to Australia, I travelled around Europe and started listening to loads of different quote-unquote queer albums. And one of the albums that was recommended to me was For the Roses, which I think came either just before or just after Blue. And that, to me, was my sort of... before Hissing of Summer Lawns, that was my main album that I sort of, that I knew. And it kind of struck me how much I loved the music on it, and specifically the sort of in listening to this album in the past 2 weeks, just hearing Joni's voice from the first time from the first song in France, They Kiss on Main Street, it was just this like overwhelming feeling of like familiarity and kind of I don't know, nostalgic safety to me, because her voice just has that transportational quality that really kind of like there's no denying that it's her.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, you know, as I made my way through this album, there's obviously quite a lot of experimentation. There were some bits that initially felt a bit kind of like jarring to me, but slowly over the course of the last couple of weeks, as I've been listening to it, have kind of revealed themselves to me. And I feel like this album and Joni as an artist is someone that will probably continue to reveal herself to me over perhaps the entirety of my life. So yeah, limited knowledge of Joni up until now, but so excited to discuss not only this album, but also her and her sort of artistry, and I guess also her relationship to the queer community and the queer experience.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there, just like it being open, like it's open to you at different points in your life, or like you'll come back to it, or like as you listen to it, it begins to grow on you. Like, I think, yeah, what you said there was like, yeah, that's it. You have to be open to that, even if there are those jarring moments. It's jarring to you now, but maybe later on it won't be so jarring, you know?
Totally. And I think that we talk a lot on the podcast about we try where we can to not cover too much contemporary music, just because things take a long time to marinate. And so when we're sort of there have been instances where we sort of covered albums that have been released in the sort of the last year or so, and they're still, you know, legitimate conversations, but I think that...
Shout out to Lil Nas X.
Shout out to Lil Nas X. Shout out to Dua Lipa. Shout out to Chromatica.
Chromatica.
But much like Chromatica, I feel like this album will reveal itself to me slowly over time. No joking. But certainly with Joni's music, you know, once you begin to get into... Like, I'm so glad that you picked this album, Matthew, because I had never heard of it. And wow. And I sort of probably wouldn't have had... the opportunity wouldn't have been afforded to me to just like listen to it unless it was mm-hmm. For this specific opportunity. And it's been so interesting and wonderful, and I'm sort of excited now to, because Joni's career has spanned so many decades, I'm excited to sort of see how things oscillate and kind of evolve and change over time. How about you, Andy? What was your Joni? What's your Joni? You said you were sort of on a Joni mission.
A Joni journey, I prefer to call it. Yeah, I guess I don't really have an awful lot to add, other than it was Matthew who really introduced some deeper cuts to me. And then over the last few years, it's been Blue. It's been, I'm going to pronounce it terribly.
Hejira.
Is it? Thank you for that. I didn't even have to whisper.
There's a couple of different pronunciations of that, but yeah.
I also absolutely love, I don't want to talk about it now, it'll come later, but I also really, really love the 2002-03 album of the jazz covers and covering herself. But I want mm-hmm. to wrap that up neatly there and come back to that. Mm-hmm. I do feel like she sits in, not to retread old ground that you've already covered, but with Bjork, Tori Amos, Kate Bush, definitely Prince, all of these artists who just exist in their own artistic world, you do have to just sometimes sit back. There are specific, you know, Bjork and Tori Amos albums. We covered Boys for Pelé on this podcast. I think of Bjork albums like Medulla, even parts of Vespertine, where on first listen, my much younger self was like, what is this crock of shite? And I can honestly say that they are now some of my favorite albums of all time. And there's something so exciting about that, because what that says to me is there are albums out there right now which I either haven't even heard of yet, or maybe haven't connected with me yet, which I might still develop amazing relationships with. And Joni's definitely one of those people. So very exciting. Yeah. But we've touched on it a little bit, and long-term listeners will know this is kind of where we're going on oral fixation in terms of, like, what does this artist or album relate to and how to the queer experience. And recently we've had a long-term listener of the pod who we gave some hot tea to. I revealed that we were doing Joni, and they said, unnamed listener said, not really sure how Joni's queer, so I'll be interested to hear why. And I think that's a really interesting thing to kind of explore straight off the bat, because we know that a lot of queer people enjoy her music. That's surface level. But I know there's a lot below the surface in terms of unpeeling. And what is it specifically about the condition she speaks about, like lyrics? What is it that you think touches something in you as a queer listener?
That's interesting to say. It's also quite funny. It's like, there's something about, I was going to jump ship to Prince and talk about Prince and like how Prince is this queer icon, but actually is a straight man, but also embodies a different type of queer, embodies a different type of queerness that is very
wide. Our decision on oral fixation is that Prince is the queerest straight man that we
absolutely
know of.
Absolutely.
Not from Robin Williams.
It's actually undefinable, and it's like you can't really box in queerness, and you can't box in something like that. But with Joni, when you mentioned For the Roses, Drew, that I connected on that album as well in a different way, and it was really like, it was almost cathartic. It was like a cathartic listening experience, because it's just like so raw. It's almost like, you know, the way that she puts lyrics together and all these like metaphors that she puts together, I think anybody can jump into listening to it and can take something away from it. So if you as a queer listener are listening to something like that, you're able to embody her experiences, which may be talking about a man and a woman's relationship, but you can then take it somewhere else as the listener, and kind of like, it's just the way that her lyrics are, the way that she works with words, and you're able to then move around, I think, with a lot of her music. And then going into Hissing of the Summer Lawns, she's creating all these characters that you have to just listen in, like Edith and Shades of Scarlet Conquering and certain parts of whatever it is she wants to depict, you're able to just kind of enter that moment and come away with something else. So I definitely think there's more to it than just, you know, is this queer or not?
Yeah, I think that you raise a really great point, Matthew, in that Joni, perhaps more than other artists I know, is certainly in the albums that I've kind of listened to, is really about creating sort of series of, whether they be autobiographical or not, mm-hmm. vignettes and like mm-hmm. And sort of delivering you characters through music. And I think some of the criticism when Hissing of Summer Lawns first came out was that it was sort of a bit difficult to follow, perhaps, or a bit sort of like there wasn't any cohesion to it, because it's just all these different kind of vignettes of different characters. But actually, sort of, if you recontextualize that and view it as a sort of a series of things that you can, yeah, tap into and perhaps identify with, and the treat is that you get to do that in maybe a few different ways, all within the context of one album. I feel like that's actually kind of quite a experimental thing to do, but also quite an artful thing to do. It's almost like this album is kind of the opposite of the quote unquote kind of like narrative album that we love. Andy and I talk a lot about how much we love albums that sort of tell one story all the way through. But there's also a lot to be said about telling like many different sporadic different stories within one piece as well.
Yeah, definitely. And even you just saying you like to look at albums that are quite old, so that it gives some time to kind of marinate and like you can understand it contextually 10 years later, 20 years later. I think a lot of the reviews Joni got in the 70s was all just basically from Rolling Stone, who, as we all know, the critics there were just like these boring white men who just wanted to make what wanted folk music to sound like folk music or rock music to sound like rock music. And because she became so experimental in the way that she was making music and there was no structure to her chords and she was creating everything else herself, they had no idea of how to pick that up. It's this thing of like me talking about having COVID and losing my sense of smell and I can't smell stuff. the stuff is still there. It's just that it wasn't, you know, in my mind, I knew that they were there, but I just couldn't understand it because I couldn't sense it. So like for these people to be writing a review about something that they don't understand, it doesn't mean that there isn't this artistry that is there. So I just think it was kind of like, it's laughable to look at like the Rolling Stones 500 top albums list or something and just see how things are ranked. And then the accolades that Bob Dylan had and stuff like that versus the ones that Joni didn't have. And then when you look at her career, yeah.
That, not to be reductive, but that in itself is queer, because I'm not trying to put her in this box, but for this woman to be kind of going through like the artistic, you know, tsunami that was the 70s for her, where she was just smashing out these incredible albums, which people will just fall over themselves to talk about their importance today, but they were being reviewed by 19-year-old straight white interns who just wanted to write for Rolling Stone. See Almost Famous for More there. Like, that is queer to me, and that people didn't get her. There'd be certain people who'd know that there was like music. There'd be certain people who'd know that there's magic in there, but that when something like that isn't recognized by the mainstream, that automatically pricks at my ears. And there was one song on this album which I didn't know this album at all until you suggested it. But there's one song that I did know, and it's the Boho Dance, because Björk covered it I think the Vespertine era. And that was the only song from this which I knew. So it was actually weird going into this hearing the original, like having like the knowledge of Björk's rendition in my mind. But I wonder why she picked this song. I wonder if there was any connection between her and this album, or whether it was just one of her favourite Joni songs.
Yeah, that's happened. Maybe we need to ask Björk. It's a funny one.
Well, funny you should say, Matthew, because dialing in now.
It's like, hello? It's a funny, like, of all the songs on that album, all the songs in Joni's, like, you know, catalogue, why the Boho Dance is this really conflicting song about the industry and bohemian lifestyles. And it's just like, it's an attraction that you cannot resist. And like, if you just listen to it, it's, but also musically, it's just so rich and there's just so much going on. It's on the second part of the album, and like, you're just like, so it starts with In France, A Kiss on Main Street, which has got so many little clicks to Court and Spark. It sounds like Court and Spark. You think, okay, I've just listened to Court and Spark. That came out 2 years before. No, that came out in 1974. So it was a year before. So it's saying, hey, this is something you're quite familiar with. They're probably written in the same time. By the time you go into the Jungle Line, which is insane as a song itself and amazing, it's like you're wrapped in. And then you've got three songs, which is just like mesmerizing. It almost feels like a cinematic tale, and you're in a sound score for a film that you haven't even seen yet. But then by the time the Boho Dance comes in, it's just like settles, and it's just like, it just 100%. Pulls you, it just kind of pulls you in this way of saying, hey, what, like, what is this lifestyle in which I want to, you want to have the successes of I guess your artistry, but there's other things that, I don't know, they're pulling and tearing at you, and you can't resist it. Or I don't know, it's such an interesting song. I don't know why Björk wanted to cover it, but it's a cool
one. It's
one
of my favourites
sure.
from the album, for sure. And I think that going back to what we were saying earlier about the fact that, you know, things take a long time to kind of to marinate or whatever, I wonder if the unnamed frequent listener who questioned to what extent Joni Mitchell is queer appreciates the fact that you can listen to Joni Mitchell now and her music by and large probably feels familiar to it, to you, because it has, as you referenced earlier, Matthew, actually informed so much of the music that's been created since. And so in a way, what was super kind of revolutionary at the time and probably quite difficult to digest for all of the 19-year-old white male interns at Rolling Stone, actually ended up defining the direction that music went in, and then so many of the people that continued to paved the trail musically that followed on from Joni were inspired by her her approach and her sound and her messaging, that it becomes kind of, in a weird way, retroactively less difficult to stomach because it's gone from being this quite subversive thing to actually being kind of almost mainstream. And that as well, I think, is a very sort of queer thing to start as an artist that sort of refuses to adhere to the status quo, but in sort of that in that passionate reluctance to bend to the, you know, the mainstream, actually ends up kind of defining a sound of an era and informing further music that's created subsequently from that is like the it's like you get 5 queer gold stars, Joni.
Yeah. I came into Joni when I was 18, going on 19, and it was like this kind of journey of growth anyway, and like, if we're going to talk about like...
Yeah, what's your journey?
Well, I began... It's funny, you mentioned Tales of the City, Andrew, because I'm going to see the friend who gave me that book tomorrow for lunch, and he lives in London, but he's from Scotland.
It's kismet.
He's in Scotland.
It's kismet.
It's a good full circle moment. But I began listening to Joni a lot when, and we became friends because we were going out when I first started like exploring my like gayness and like hooking up with people. And we just started hooking up and kind of had like a 2-month, 3-month thing of like, yeah, we weren't a thing, but there was something definitely going on, and then we became friends afterwards. But around that time, I was listening to, I think my first Joni album was Ladies of the Canyon, or maybe even Wild Things Run Fast. I can't remember. It was random, and I was just going through stuff. And then by the time I got to like Kissings Over Summer Lawns, I also was just like exploring myself, and each album represents this early moment of me exploring what it meant to be hooking up with men and being in London and understanding where I was going, this double life that I was leading at that time, because I also didn't really understand what I was up to, out of like being a teenager, finishing sixth form, going into college, having this independence and freedom to go to different parts of London. So on those journeys to like, I guess, either to college or then to a boyfriend who I would be like hooking up with, on those bus journeys, I'd be listening to a Joni album easily. And I can definitely pinpoint how I felt during that period of time, going from somewhere that was like my mum's house to then a boyfriend's house. And that transition of like, I'm just going out for the night, to then turning up back at like 9 a.m, 10 a.m. the next morning. And we're like, yeah, it was a fun night, but just like, it was this transitional thing that was going on. I couldn't really understand it then, but in between all of that, on these journeys, I'm listening to Court and Spark, I'm listening to Blue, I'm listening to Hajira and Don Juan's Reckless Daughter and stuff like that. And throughout it all, it's just like, it's a part of my makeup, of my foundations of who I am now. And the way that she was writing about whatever it was she was writing, I just connected to the metaphors in her lyrics and the poetry in it and the way in which she was talking about certain characters or certain little moments about life. It's just a perspective. I think the whole 60s drug taking, very free kind of like acid and trippy stuff allowed, and her exposure and being a part of all of that allowed this real kind of like trippy outtake on the world, and the way, and she, you can definitely see that in her lyrics, and also the experimentation of knowing that as people we are, you know, there's no such thing as individualism to a degree, like you are a part of a bigger thing. And she was always really looking for the makeups or the things that make, or, you know, I think she was just very aware of capitalism and consumerism and aware of who's been pushed out to make the 70s world move forward, especially in the big cities like New York and LA and stuff like that, and the Western world anyway. And so, yeah, going back to just like my makeup of it, I was just listening to all this stuff and it really blew my mind. Blew my mind as a 19-year-old. And everybody I kept hanging out with, I was like, you should listen to this. You should, like, my best friend who I was best friends with in school, I was like, you should listen to that. If you can't deal with Joni, maybe listen to Kate Bush. Work your way up. And like, if you can't handle Joni now, then start on like a pop level or something. Just like, just enter it at your own point and then you can go further.
And if you can't handle Kate Bush, start with Florence and the Machine. And if you can't handle Florence and the Machine, start with Diana Vickers and you'll get there.
It's all just slowly making your way up to the pinnacle, the top of the tower, which is Joni.
If you can get to Joni, you've made it.
That's so interesting that those train tracks were being laid at 19 to take you, like, one, forming the way that you view the world, forming the way that you enjoy music. But do you think that Joni coming to you at that really formative time led you directly to other artists who you do love, some of who we've mentioned, some who maybe we haven't mentioned?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I think I was just eager to listen to everything and anything. I'm eager to listen to everything and anything now. But you just absorb and absorb. I think back then I was just like downloading anything off LimeWire, downloading, even then I was very much even looking at, I shouldn't be saying
the original virus.
But I was, absolutely. And I also was looking at the Rolling Stones, like, top 100 list or whatever. I was like, okay, if they've, even back then, I was like, okay, fine, I should probably listen to that and review it in my own way and like see why it's got 5 stars or something. And just try to make some kind of reference point for myself. But
Matthew, am I right to assume that you're around the same age as Andy?
I'm 32.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah.
But, basically, yeah. Then. Yeah, pretty much. Because Andy's 30, I'm 34, you're 32. So there's, you know, I guess Andy and I sort of bookend the age difference. But I just absolutely love the idea of you aged like 18, 19 in, without doing too much fast maths, I imagine 2007 or 8.
Yeah.
When you like could very well have been listening to Girls Aloud or, you know, whatever.
Don't get me wrong, I was.
But also you're on the bus on the way to this hookup listening to Joni. There's something about that I just absolutely stan. It's not this kind of like, I think that, you know, as queer people, we are, for some reason, and I still haven't perhaps figured out quite why, but we're more open to going further back in time at that young age to sort of like really search for that music that will speak to us. But I just love the idea of you kind of making your way through London in 2007, listening to Joni on the bus.
That's deep. We are always searching, aren't we? I mean, it's because all of our stuff is erased and there's a lot of pulling through the bushes to find the real information because it's been covered up a lot. So we are always doing a little bit, okay.
We're looking constantly to see ourselves reflected, and I think that formative age is so important because we are so desperate to see glimpses and glimmers, and we will follow, like our noses will follow the trail. We've talked about it before on here that that's why it's so important, not just to see, you know, flat out visibility, but to see just clues and breadcrumbs, which lead you onto different things and everywhere, even if it's not just, you know, TV or music, but, and especially books, but, you know, even seeing art and art, you know, art is queer. Art pop.
I was obsessed and still am obsessed with the 70s. So like this is mid 1975. I always think what makes, you know, when you're making music or when these albums are coming out, what else is going on in the world? And we know what was happening in like New York, the 70s, like everybody was hooking up and parties were happening. Discos were going and what else was going on, you know, around the world. And I always find it really obsessive that I'm like, okay, I want to know more. And so you made this album with this, like, so let's go back to the album, but like, it's a jazz fusion album and it's fused with rock. Oh, so many other different things that can't really be I don't think you can label, because it's just like experimental jamming. And it sticks to the rules of, I guess, jazz, which has no rules. Oh, there are rules, there's many rules, but it's just playing off of the person that are in the room or the session players. But then you listen to the demos of the songs and they hold... Have you heard the demos of Hissons of the Sunrise? They're incredible, because it's like, okay, you listen to the finalized version, but then you listen to her demos and all of this, like, all the melodies are all there. She's just done it off the guitar, and the way that she structured the songs, it's just like, oh my God, it's mind blowing. It's on YouTube if you want to just listen to it. But going deep back cuts. To it, yeah, I just think, yeah, the deep cuts. I was thinking, what's going on at that time, and like, why is something come about? And I think it's this obsessive wanting to know more about a time that was just like, you think the height of like everything, like the height of just like before a lot of things started come crashing down in the 80s because of AIDS and a lot of other things.
Yeah, it's so interesting the way you just sort of described that era, Matthew, because it really was the kind of like the look. I'm not saying that the world was perfect at that time, but I guess to be an artist or a queer person or someone that sort of parties in the margins, the mid 70s was actually like an awesome time, I guess, because ignorance is bliss, and sort of not knowing what was about to come. And I guess the sort of the mythology around the recent past is that, you know, from ever since the, I guess, the creation of the internet, but certainly from sort of about, I would say, a decade ago, and then now going throughout time, probably for the rest of time, everything is recorded. We know pretty much everything that's happened, and sort of where and when and why and how, down to the second, because of stuff like social media and the internet at large. Whereas back in like the 70s, there's many, many hours of pontificating we could do about, you know, the intricacies of the why and like and the how, but we can still only kind of piece it together and so with sort of limited information. So there's still this sort of, I guess, element of myth around it. Stuff like Woodstock, stuff like Studio 54. You know, there's like all this rhetoric around it that has a sort of a general narrative to it, but there's always going to be these untold stories and this stuff that we just can never know, never humanly know. And that's, there's something really kind of exciting about that.
Something I wanted to discuss and explore your thoughts on, speaking about, you know, influences and times and what made, you know, what shaped that art. I found it really interesting in just reading about this album and Joni that it sounds like the fact that she had a child so young and that child was kind of given away and adopted by other parents has like profoundly shaped her writing career in a way that I was like kind of shocked to see how important it was to the songs that she was writing, right down through to, you know, she was so young. I think it was like 1964 when she was actually pregnant. And then all of the albums which followed in that period of like, you know, massive creativity. She's gone on record as saying that when she was reunited with her child as an adult in like the late 90s, that she actually lost any interest in songwriting, and not in a negative way, but in the sense that losing a child or giving away a child so young had propelled her creativity for literally decades. And in a really beautiful way, just putting two and two together, it sounds like being reunited with that person all those years later, it sounds like it was the closure that she'd been searching for all this time, but that need for closure had generated so much incredible art. And it's just so interesting that like 30 years of music have been produced, propelled mostly by, you know, this massive loss so young, and how formative that was. I didn't know any of that before.
I it's sad, and it's also kind of insane to think that, you know, that could be the main reason to, you know, become really creative. It's also quite beautiful. I'm glad they reunited.
Yeah, me too. I think there's a lot to be said for, I guess, not only the sort of, and without having ever gone through the experience that Joni went through, I can only sort of pontificate on it.
Yet.
Yet. Any, you know, you never know what's going
to
happen.
Do you want to?
but there's, I guess there's two sides to that coin in that, yes, that experience fueled her creatively, but there's also a lot to be said for the cathartic nature of music. And as you say, Andy, maybe once she had reunited with her sort of estranged child and reached that place of some sort of reciprocity, that sort of catharsis, that was the catharsis. She had reached that point that she needed to and was sort of trying to expunge through her music. And so I guess after that, because she has released music since, but I guess that was just sort of a huge chapter closed and then sort of, yeah, another one opening. But very, and it reminded me, not sort of that it was exactly the same experience, but recently, Matthew, we spoke about Sinead O'Connor, who also had a child very young, kind of on the precipice of her career starting. And she was told, you know, you won't be big and famous if you're a mother. And sort of she had to reconcile that those conversations with like asshole record company executives. And in a different way, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand it, Joni's having given birth and giving her child away was a sort of not a known thing. Yeah. But there is this sort of, I guess, this fuel to like, if I'm going to pursue my career, if I'm going to do this thing, then I've got to do it because I've given up so much. You know, she moved across Canada and then down into the US to sort of pursue this this dream that she had. And yeah, in a way, it kind of reminded me that fire, which as I need to sort of make pains to underline, I do not profess to understand the emotions that come along with motherhood or young motherhood or the sort of the relinquishing of motherhood,
yeah,
to a certain extent. But yeah. But there were just interesting parallels with the discussion we had recently about Sinead and that sort of that drive and that fire. In some way, perhaps speaking to the queer experience as well, and sort of, you know, feeling subjugated by the sort of overarching straight white male oppressor, and kind of fighting against that. So, and it's not as simple as that. There are nuances to everyone's experience, but yeah, it was just a sort of an interesting parallel.
Yeah, there's so much going on. It's so sad though when you think about that. And it's still happening today, in which people are told that their careers are not going to be. Well, women are told their careers are not going to be anything if they're going to try and balance it with motherhood. You see that, and you see people fighting against it, like Serena, for instance, within sports, or just like people being like, "Okay, my child is here, and they're going to come to the stage, or they're going to be here present." Even with Beyonce, and like people thinking, oh, she's pregnant, she's not going to release another album now for like 4 years or something, or just thinking about what motherhood does to someone's career and just trying to counter that. And then and our expectations and demands on these artists of what they should be giving us, where actually it's us who should be quite lucky that they're releasing the stuff that we like, and not them, or like, you know, us being like, Rihanna, where's the album? Let Rihanna live her life. Like, you know.
Excuse me, though. It has been a while now. Come on. I've been very patient.
Like, I mean, it would just, you know, it might never come.
It might never. That's wild that it might never
come.
If
so, she ended on a high.
You know. So.
I would love to know from the two of you, are there any songs that we haven't mentioned or that we have and you want to just give a bit more attention to from the hissing of summer lawns? Go for it, Matthew.
Absolutely. There's so much going on that album. There is on Edith and the Kingpin.
Love that.
As we're talking, like, you know, yeah, it's incredible.
That's
like,
my, I would say Edith, that's probably Kingpin. My top.
Yeah. Just the way that you're just, like, dropped in it. So, like, at the end of in France, they kiss them, Main Street, it's... it goes, we go rolling, and then it just, you go rolling right into these drums that is a jungle line, right? And then you get Edith yes. and the Kingpin out of that, and it's so smooth that you're just like transcended into this world. And you can hear her, you can hear like the way that she's putting the melodies together. And I think there's just like layers of vocals where she's like making these sounds, and then you've got the instruments that come in. So she's got all these like session players who are like incredible musicians in their own right and have played for like the Crusaders and like jazz quartets and stuff like that, that you're just like, wow, I'm in a film. It's like a score, like you're in it. I think, how do you feel about Edith and the Kingpin?
Yeah, like I think, like as I said, it's my it's probably my favorite from the album. And the reason that I think I connected with it so much is because it is of the sort of spectrum of the album, it probably feels more on the like Joni that I'm used to side of things. But I think Edith and the Kingpin, Don't Interrupt the Sorrow, and Sweet Bird are probably my three favorites, because they all have this kind of like, and I guess actually in particular, Don't Interrupt the Sorrow and Sweet Bird, they have this like kind of like, I don't know what the technical term to it is, but it's this like country twang, like
yeah.
thing.
Definitely.
That's
on Sweet Bird.
Beautiful, Drew.
But I think that actually when we spoke to Fanny, she like described the actual technical term for it. But it's there's something just purely subjectively that like specific sound does to like the inner chambers of my heart. For some reason, it just like completely selfishly pulls me into any song. And that kind of, yeah, that country influence to those songs really, 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 really struck me. And then I would say Hissing on Summer Lawns as well was probably my other favorite.
The bass line, oh
yeah, and
like, dun, 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 dun.
Just the I guess the I felt in going back to the point we were touching on earlier about Joni being an incredible sort of character builder, she's also, I mean, it's kind of a bit of a no-brainer, but she's also just such an incredible storyteller, and the way she paints these pictures that I can literally listen to that song and close my eyes and see this scene that she's kind of describing to me. It's yeah, it was really kind of, I think in a weird way, maybe going back to what we were saying earlier about the fact that Joni and other artists around the same time have sort of informed music that's come since. I think I take that stuff really for granted. I take that kind of storytelling and that pastiche creating really, really for granted, because nowadays with lyrics, it's kind of a pop song, like the formula of a pop song is you pick like a cool word and then just create something around it and like have like an interesting hook and, you know, sort of yeah. reference like cultural touchstones of the time. But like back in the day, like really, really like creating this poetry and setting it to music, it was just like a completely different beast. And I think that I sleep on artists like Joni because I'm so overwhelmed and used to lyricism across such a sort of wider spectrum that I don't really kind of give her flowers, her roses. Andy, do you have any faves?
On top of what you've already said, my only other favourite I mentioned would be Shades of Scarlet Conquering for the drama mama, the
you
piano,
love conquering
the,
that's my favourite.
Oh, is it really?
Absolute favourite.
Yeah, I really love
Harry's
that.
House and the ones. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is, but Shades of Scarlet Concrete. Oh my god!
Yes, I'm really, really glad that. Like, honestly, if it was just Drew and I, because Joni would come up eventually, I do think that she's always stood out to me as she's definitely not an underdog. She's anything but, really, but she's not a classical, conventional queer icon at all. She's one of those artists who everyone loves, but a lot of queer people do very much revere her for decent reason. And I think if it was just Drew and I who sat down, I would have been pushing for Blue because you know, it's this masterpiece. It's gone down in history as one of the best examples of a true confessional pop album, but true artistry. So the entire thing is this young woman in her early 20s who, like I said earlier, didn't know until recently that she was mourning the loss of a child. She was mourning this long-term relationship which had just ended, but she was also in the throes of an exciting new relationship. It's all of those high drama hormonal emotions of your early 20s amped up in an album which is produced, written by, created by this one creative genius. And Blue is a very special album. However, the fact that you directed us down this path, I'm really, really glad about, because it shows an artist who has had their enormous sweeping success, but has still so much more to give. And there's an audience out there who probably just want more Blue, just give us more. They want the Blues, the Babadees, but this is someone who's at their artistic kind of crescendo and doing exactly what they want to do.
Exactly. Those two points I was going to bring up, because like in all her previous albums, like in Hiss and the Summer Lawns, if you look at the in sleeve, there's this beautiful photograph of Joni spread out, taken by Norman Seeff in a bikini in the pool, just kind of like drifting.
Joni.
This is the first album we see Joni's like full kind of like showing off, essentially, in this way. For the Roses, you kind of see her set up on the hilltop in, you see her, but in, other than that, it's just paintings. You don't really get the photographs, and it's only until, and in Blue it's just kind of like her face, but until this point you don't really, she doesn't really show off in this way. So, and then
interesting.
From that you then start to see this relationship develop with her photographer Norman Seeff in all the other albums. And I couldn't talk about, I think my favourite, like I have a period which I think is Ajaira and Don Juan's Reckless Daughter. Like Don Juan's Reckless Daughter for me is Joni at peak. Peak, wow. Like.
Further listening, listeners. You heard it here.
Lyricism, experimentation, working with other musicians and giving them the freedom to do what they do on your songs, to then take it to another level. I think it's just like incredible.
That's actually very Prince.
Yeah. But Prince wouldn't have got that from. Prince says his influences are Sly, Stone, and Joni Mitchell, and amongst other people like Larry Graham and people like that. But you couldn't talk about those albums without talking about Hissing of the Summer Lawns, because there's a turning point from where you've got the high-pitched squeals of her folk albums in the late 60s, early 70s, to Blue and Court and Spark. Then there's a shift between Court and Spark and Hiss of the Summer Lawns. And I think you just have to really like focus in on that mid-70s period before you can talk about some of the other things she got to do in the late 70s. And I couldn't be like, oh, my favourite album's this, without saying, hey, why did that album happen? How did she get to that point? What was her trajectory? And I think it's just like this big journey for her.
I get it now. She was on her own journey. And when you Absolutely. First were telling me that you couldn't make up your mind, you didn't know what album to pick, I was like, come on, Matthew, you've got to pick one. I'm going to need an answer. Drew and I have got to listen. We've got to start streaming. We've got to get on Spotify and start streaming. But I do now, with that additional context, understand you were having a bit of an internal tug of war, and I can kind of understand why. However, speaking of, that may be a useful segue into Joni beyond this album. So there is so much Joni to cover off. We do not have all of the time. So many cultural touch points. I mean, I could start. Or did anyone else want to?
Go on,
Ed. Go on. You deserve some airtime. Go on.
The listeners always write in and say we want to hear more of Andy's opinions. So go on, Andy.
So every episode, I just try and increase incrementally. So I'm not going to crap on about Blue, but specifically that song, the one song on there, River. River's one of those songs in the back of my mind. I've always known it for years, but it was actually, and not until a recent Soul Music episode, shout out to the BBC4's podcast Soul Music, where they did an episode on River, that it just hit me like a ton of bricks. It initially obviously sounds like a Christmas song, but it's definitely not. It's so sad and tragic and heartbreaking, and I can't get over how someone so young could put something like that out there. My second point was around when we did our Prince episode on Aura Fixation. I actually hadn't yet fallen in love with what now I do actually think is my favorite Prince album of all time, which is Sign of the Times. And on Sign of the Times, there's an incredible song called The Ballad of Dorothy Parker, where he directly interpolates Joni's Help Me, which is one of Prince's many shout outs to his icon, his goddess, his queen.
I was just going to say, funny enough, that it's called Dorothy, The Ballad of Dorothy Parker, in the same way that we're talking about Shades of Scarlet Conquering or Edith and the Kingpin. He is referencing this character building lyricism, and also he just jumps into Court and Spark, Help Me. There's just so many little nods. You kind of cluck these little nods in both their careers, and just like admiration for each other. But go on, sorry.
When we were talking earlier about songs that we'd gifted each other or whatever, I feel like I could be making this up. You're going to have to verify or cancel, because I am sure we had an in-depth discussion as to like 19, 20-year-olds about the genius of Janet Jackson's Got Till It's Gone, and how she specifically reached out to Joni Mitchell for permission for that sample, and how it became this incredible, beautiful song in its own right, but actually samples this entirely separate, amazing Joni Mitchell song. And that's one of my favorite Janet Jackson songs as well.
I don't remember this conversation, but that's true.
Can you just say, for the sake of this episode, I remember talking to you about that, and it was as profound as it had just explained.
Okay, delete the past 20 seconds. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that, Andrew. That was so, yeah. And sampling, the art of sampling. It's a completely different song. I actually didn't even know it was referencing.
Can I ask you boys something, though, which I read earlier, and I don't know if it's true or not. Did Joni Mitchell, invent sampling? Or the album,
The Jungle Land.
Yeah, isn't that one of the first examples of sampling?
Yeah, I think so. I've read in a few reviews or just like bits where it's like it's taken from a Burundi tribe's drumming, a recording of them drumming, and I think so. That's what it says. I couldn't really verify, but that's what Wikipedia says.
That's what I read, on noted news information website Wikipedia. It's one of, if not the, one of like an early example of sampling. And so then for her music to be sort of referenced and sampled throughout time ever since is sort of obviously very cool.
I think that is also why she wasn't getting reviews about but like really like the accolades. I think she went so left field from what people could deal with at that time that they were just like, oh, I'm not going to even bother. I can't deal with it. If she's not standing in front of a microphone with a guitar, I can't comprehend what this is. Or like she's out of her depth or something. And I think that also like probably was the reason why she wasn't being as supported in this experimentation as other people in the 70s was. And if she was a man, they would have probably given them, you know, the claps and the flowers and everything else. Hello. To go along with it.
But Kate Bush went on to experience that herself in the 70s and 80s when she would start to produce her own albums and people would kind of turn their nose up at The Dreaming, for example. It wasn't until The Hounds of Love where people were like, oh, actually, she's a genius. Bjork had it herself in the 90s where she was making entire albums from her laptop and people would be like, you're crazy. It's so weird and out there. Yeah. Well, yeah. Yeah. Well.
Yeah.
Matthew, Drew, Any other Joni T from either of you? Drew, tell us about Love Actually, noted queer masterpiece.
Shout out to Emma Thompson. The only particularly queer thing that I have learnt about Joni Mitchell in researching for this episode is that apparently she started smoking when she was 9. That's
iconic.
That's iconic. That is iconic. Don't smoke. And actually we're coming up to...
Yes, we're not promoting that.
We're not. We're coming up to my 5th year anniversary of not smoking. So don't smoke.
That's good.
But if you're a 9-year-old in Canada and you're looking
on
to...
On the prairies.
Looking to make it big, pick up a packet of cigarettes and just see what happens. They they have transportational powers and they will make you famous. Matthew, do you have any... obviously, you're a huge Joni stan, but do you have any little sort of... If this is the end of the yoga class, there's one stretch left... There's one little thing that you could share.
Maybe. I'm also obsessed with the 80s, which I think many of us are, and certain things, or like some of the sounds that was coming from there. And I think she was still experimenting in the 80s with a lot of her sound making. Some of those albums are, I think my most listened to Joni album is Chalkmark in a Rainstorm, which some would say is her worst album. But I think I play so much because it, does, you know, certain things, you have your own personal journey with albums or music, and it definitely calms me when I need it. I think a lot of her 80s stuff is great, like I love it to death. Dog Eat Dog is amazing, and yeah, Wild Things Run Fast. There's this really beautiful thing in Chinese Cafe, I don't know if either of you have listened to it, which is the first song on Wild Things Run Fast. That's like 81, I think that came out. Or 82, one of the two, where she's just talking in this reflective way. It's back to kind of like quintessential Joni, where she's just like making you, she's dropping you in it, but she's just talking about life reflections and like, you're just like, wow. There's a line where she starts saying like, Christmas is coming in or something, and the kids are playing on the lawn. We look like our mothers now when we were those kids' age. And she's like, 40, she's in her 40s, and you're just like, and it just starts stabbing at you, and you're just like, yeah, she has that power to just continue to have the pin and just prodding at your heartstrings, and you're like, wow.
She does.
I think all of her 80s music is just as strong, and even the 90s stuff where she becomes really, like, I don't know, she's trying to do her activism by pulling these stories within...
The Magdalene Laundries?
Yeah, exactly. Oh my God, tears.
I remember you giving me The Sire of Sorrow and that blowing my very young mind.
Do you want to cry? Listen to that if you
want
to
cry. Ready. Well, speaking of crying and speaking of aging, my last yoga stretch is, part of it is kind of like a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason in that I think one of her defining moments as an artist... And Joni hardcore fans will roll their eyes at this, but for the mainstream, certainly. When she covered herself and she remade Both Sides Now as someone in her mid to late 50s, she was covering a song that she'd written at like 23 or 24. And when that song came out, people would talk about how she was so wise beyond her years. How could this really young woman foresee the future in that way and tap into these feelings? And that is amazing in itself. But like the sincerity and the sentimentality of that young girl growing into this older woman and living all of those experiences that she talked about living and actually feeling them. I do think that the remake of Both Sides Now supersedes the original. The original is beautiful and you can have them both. You don't need one or the other, but there's like a magic and a power of the re-recorded version, which really hits and feels different. And we've talked about it before on this pod because Kate Bush has done that herself with, you know, Moments of Pleasure and various people have done it and covered themselves as an older person. And I think the pinnacle, the best example that I can think of is Joni redoing Both Sides Now.
Yeah, it's the artistry and the archive is always open. Like, you should, it's not a closed chapter, like you should always keep delving back in. And I think that's the artistic nature of, it's like people who get it, like the world is like either people who get it or people who don't. And it's like understanding that this journey of your life, how short that might be, it needs to be as open and experimental and open to different experiences as possible.
And I think that there's a lot to be said for the length of Joni's career and the fact that there aren't many artists really that can boast, I mean, I'm not going to try.
Years?
Yeah, like I was going to say, I'm not going to try and do the maths, but like just decades and decades and decades. And I think the interesting thing about the Both Sides Now thing is that you can, if you compare those two songs in the more recent version, you can, like, the aging of her voice and the sort of the baggage of the way she's singing it is so prevalent. And it's not, it's melancholy in a way, but it's also, there's power behind it. And it kind of, it just, yeah, it punctuates the journey she's been on, the journey she's taken us on. Or I guess her fans, I should say, because I'm sort of a recently indoctrinated Joni stan. But there's not many artists. And I think when we talk about age, we talk a lot about how Madonna kind of paved the way for being a sort of artist. When she was in her mid-30s, people were saying, shut up, grandma, you know, and she's continued to kind of like defy that. But Joni seems almost kind of timeless. Like there's, to my knowledge, there's never really been this sort of narrative around her age and it being a sort of something that has stifled her career. She has just continued to evolve and grow and taken us along with her and sort of let us into that aging process, or that sort of, you know, the development of her life and her voice and her point of view has kind of been an open door that we've all been welcomed in on. And I think that's something that's quite unique. And I'm even sort of, as I'm talking about it now, it's just interesting that there aren't many artists that are like Joni in that respect. Yeah. I think.
It's sad, and it's a societal thing, isn't it? When we, unlike, it's the way we box genres in, like, for instance, if you even talk about Madonna, that's happened because she, I guess, is a pop artist, and the way that we box pop artists in to be commercialized and how they're packaged up and have to sell. And so if we're not consuming them in this way, then they're beyond their sell-by date or something. Whereas if it's an artistic endeavor in which somebody, and usually it is around, it's weird how we box genres in, or like the coin, art rock, for instance. You don't hear art being put in front of any other genre of music.
Art pop.
Art pop, fine. But you don't see it in anything else.
No.
And it's just, it's a weird thing in which as a society we do to people and the way in which we consume these musicians.
Well, gents, I wasn't gonna open it, but considering that you two opened the immaculate section before me, the section of the pod where I desperately try and associate our subject to the Queen of Pop, I do have to say that Madonna has cited Mitchell as the first female artist that really spoke to her as a teenager. She says, "I was really, really into Joni Mitchell. I knew every word to Court and Spark. I worshipped her when I was in high school. Blue is amazing, and I'd have to say of all the women I've heard, she had the most profound effect on me from a lyrical point of view."
There we go.
There you go.
Yes, Madge. Yes, Madge. Go on.
Madam X has spoken.
And Matthew X has spoken. Thank you so much for your time, Matthew. Thank you so much for finally giving in to my begging and pleading. And it was so great to have your voice on the pod.
It's so nice to chat with both of you. Nice to see your faces. So I haven't actually spoken to you, Andy, in ages, so it's been nice to do 2 hours of chit-chat.
Matthew, do you have on the sort of scale of incognito to out there full open door Joni, where do you sit? Do you have anything to plug? Do you have a social media account that people can follow you on? What's your vibe?
I'm fine with being followed.
Where can people find Jungle Hussy, more importantly?
You just have You just have to type it in. Just type in Django Messi. And you shall find, or you can, or with my art practice, you can just use my name.
Which is?
Matthew Arthur Williams. Yeah, you can find me around. Here, there, and everywhere. Here, there, and
everywhere.
But, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Well, if you would like to follow these two hussies, you can. I'm at With All Due Respect. Andy's at Andrew Do You Think You Are. And the podcast is at Oral Fixation Podcast on Instagram. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at Oral Fix Pod, which of course is queer. We're also on Facebook. We have a website, oralfixationpodcast.com. You can email us, oralfixationpodcast@gmail.com. But most importantly, put down your phone right now, press stop, go to the app, like, subscribe, follow, leave a review, leave a 5-star review. Tell us what you think. In all seriousness, your reviews and your comments and your ratings allow people to find us easier. So do please leave a review if you can. And thank you so much. I've got to go because there's a big yellow taxi just waiting for me outside. So the screen doors are about to swing, so I better pop off.
You go get it, okay, doll.
You do it.
Okay. Yeah. I'll catch you later.
You gotta go for it's gone.
Oh, no.
You gotta go for it's gone.
Very good.
Beautiful. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. The cave paradise, put up a pie.